Hi, Christian. Thanks so much for coming onto the show and helping us out with some of the science here.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Right. So we're going to start along with the start of episode two with some of the Cambrian explosion. So we hear this term quite a bit when we're looking at the news and when we're looking at the evolution of life. But what is the Cambrian explosion? Like, what does it actually refer to?
So, of course, it was not an explosion as the term suggests. It's nothing that happened like in a fraction of a second. It was also not violent, but probably rather slow. But what happened is that we have at the transition from the Proterozoic to the Phanerozoic, so about 550 million years ago, we have suddenly a load of fossils, actually of big fossils, of visible fossils, where you don't need microscopes to see them. And this was actually a riddle for a long time, what has happened there. And actually, until some decades ago, many people thought there were actually no fossils, or at least no big fossils in strata that were older. So something must have happened, and people know this for a long time. And there's actually many different things that happened at the same time, and which are, of course, linked in a way ecologically. And it's quite exciting. And also, we have some really spectacular fossil sites like the Burgess Shale, like Xinjiang, like Sirius Passet in Greenland, where we find fossils that are just unbelievably well preserved, showing all details of soft tissues, including nerves, muscles, whatsoever. So it's a great number of data, information, fossils we have from around that time, which gives us now a fairly detailed picture of what has happened.
Yeah, let's have a look at some of the animals and different organisms in a second. But I want to get an idea of what has caused this Cambrian explosion. And I guess there's kind of two arms to that. There's what has caused the sudden like appearance of all of these new animals and different organisms that have just appeared. And then the other side of it is like, why has it just appeared? Why don't we see this beautiful slow transition and the slow appearance? Why do they all come in at once? Is it something to do with like the rocks and how they preserve some things and not others? What is it?
So it's, I guess it's a mix of things. So first of all, what happened is that many groups evolved hard parts, skeletons of various compositions. So this is the main reason why we suddenly find fossils of them, like big fossils, like visible fossils, fossils where you don't need microscopes. So that's one thing. The question is, of course, what has happened before? Is it just because of preservation and they were in fact there, or did they just evolve all at the same time? And I guess the truth is somewhere in between, as so often. So it is also actually very complex, but of course, we don't have the time to go into all the details to to discuss that. But maybe one important aspect is, of course, that the atmosphere has changed over the past billion of years. So more and more oxygen was available in the atmosphere and therefore also in the water. And so step by step, organisms developed from those which are more bacteria-like to those to actually eventually multicellular life, and then from multicellular life, of course, eventually actual animals. And we find animal-like organisms already like between half a billion and a billion year ago old sediments. But they look quite awkward, and the forms that are more familiar or look more familiar to what we have today, this starts then really with a Paleozoic, with the Cambrian, and there's a lot of arthropods and so like crustacean related animals and other critters that were around that at least remotely look to what we know.
So for the new audiences that we're hopefully getting with this, like, everyone's going to be familiar with dinosaurs, they're going to be familiar with mammoths and saber-toothed cats, all things like that. They may know about trilobites and hopefully sea scorpions, of course. But if we are going back this far, like, they might not be aware of all of the different organisms that were about at this time. So what are some of the ones that they might have heard of or that they should have heard of?
Yeah, well, of course, obviously the Raeidons come to mind, the Anomalocaridids, a really awkward group, actually, which grew to quite impressive sizes in the Cambrian to maybe about a meter, in the Ordovician a bit later then, well, a bit, some tens of million years later, they grew to actually several meters in size. And they have actually a quite funny history, because in the early days of research on Cambrian fossils, in this case on the Canadian Burgess Shale, parts of this animal were found, and they have appendages at the front of the head that remotely look like shrimps, like what you eat when you go to a seafood restaurant. Mm-hmm. And so they were described as a crustacean because people didn't get that this was just the body part and not not the whole animal. And then secondly, they found something that looked like a jellyfish, because it is radially symmetric. It looks like it has like a fourfold symmetry, like jellyfish do. But it turned out that this was actually the mouth of the same animal. So that is kind of a peculiar story that is actually true for several animals that have been discovered in the Cambrian Lagerstätten, as we call it, and in the conservation deposits. And in the case of the Anomalocaridids, this animal, as I said, grew to maybe about a meter in size, in length, and it had these downward bent frontal appendages, which it used for grasping prey like trilobites or so. And the mouth was circular. And it looks like to our very rear end of our digestive system, if I may say that. But it was really the mouth, and it probably could move apart those regularly arranged tooth-like structures to actually put any animal it has caught into its mouth and process it further. And it had on its side, it had a series of many flaps, which it used in an undulating movement to float along, like maybe if you've seen sepias, the modern day cephalopods, when they swim, they use fins which also wave up and down, and they probably did the same thing for swimming. So they were very likely capable of swimming movements, which is also quite relevant, I think.
Yeah, they look incredibly alien, I think, is one thing. But when they do appear, so Anomalocaridids specifically, and I might as well point, I don't think you pointed it out, but Anomalocaris actually means strange shrimp, which is in reference to that appendage. That's where they got the name from.
Exactly.
But yeah, when they do appear, they appear like they don't... how am I going to say this? They are like very advanced. What I'm trying to get at is that they aren't rubbish.
Fully functional and complete and quite different to what else we know. I mean, these Lagerstätten, so these very special fossil sites which we have on the planet, there is maybe in the meantime, like I would say about 20 of them. And but this sounds like a lot, maybe, but if you take into account that they are spread over tens of millions of years, and also they're spread all over the planet, so there's a lot of evolutionary detail we are missing there. So this being said, we have troubles actually extrapolating how they evolved in detail. Of course, we do see a bunch of different species. I don't know, there's some tens of species in the meantime from the Cambrian to the Ordovician. And we do see some evolution there, but we don't, as far as I know, and I'm not the leading expert in Anomalocaridid research, we do not really know in great detail how the Anomalocaridids evolved. So how the appendages evolved in detail and so on. And for example, also the eyes, they're super complex, like in both senses. They're complex eyes, so they're compound eyes, and they're super complex in that sense that some of the species have really thousands of single lenses. So they're really highly developed eyes already so early in Earth history.
Yeah, and that's like my little area of speciality that I love to research. And I like to tell people that arthropod eyes like that work like pixels on a screen. So we've all got our full HD tellies that are 1920 by 1080 pixels. The more pixels you have in there, the better the resolution. And it's the same for arthropod eyes. The more lenses they have, the better a picture of their world they can build. And there's nothing like Anomalocaris until you get to the like modern dragonflies in terms of resolution. So as soon as they've evolved, they have these amazing eyes that can like picture the world like nothing else that we've seen before it, nothing else that we've seen after for millions of years. They really were quite advanced in a lot of ways. So I feel it's very easy to look at this time and think that everything is really simplistic and basic and only just evolved. But these things, they were specialists at what they did. They were fantastic at what they did and living in the way that they did. So
there's maybe another important piece of information to understand that, because they're related to insects and crustaceans and other arthropods. But in contrast, for example, to trilobites and crustaceans like crayfish, their shell was actually not very strongly mineralized. So to get them preserved, you need special preservation conditions. So for that reason, actually, we missed them in many localities where they might have lived, but for preservation reason, it's not possible to get their shells preserved.
Like the amount of missing data that we have this far back, it blows my mind just how different the world would have been to what we can actually see preserved in the fossil record. I would love to go back.
Me too. But only with a good big bottle of oxygen.
All right, okay. So, yeah. What, for being underwater or because of the atmosphere?
Because of the atmosphere, because oxygen was really, really low compared to today. You wouldn't survive on land.
Right. Okay. Well, plenty of oxygen then. Yeah. And it's really important as well to note that there's other animals other than Anomalocaris, and there's diversity in those Anomalocarids, and there's an unknown diversity of Anomalocaridids out there as well. So there must have been absolute tons of them in there. It's so exciting.
Absolutely. And I mean, even in the Burgess Shale, you'd imagine maybe if you have such a special group of moderately big predators, you would assume there are maybe not too many, but actually there were other similar related animals like Lagania or so, which is actually quite closely related, and they lived more or less at the same time. And there's other one of these huge radiodons around, plus many other arthropods, and the diversity just in the Burgess Shale is stunning. All the arthropods that are present, and then all the other groups like all sorts of worms, of sponges, and actually of many important groups we have today. We have the very remote ancestors, including also very early vertebrates. So that's also interesting. Well, vertebrate in a very broad sense. I would say maybe chordates to be a bit more on the safe side. But very remote ancestors of ourselves, actually. And that's also quite interesting. But they looked really a bit more worm-like than we do.
Yeah. Well, we eventually see some jawless fishes in this episode as well. So, yeah. But you're completely right. There's so much. And we could do... Oh, we could talk about this for hours.
Absolutely.
There's so much in there. And as the old adage goes, like in the Cambrian, you could be the second largest predator to Anomalocaris, yet nobody's ever heard of you.
Yeah. Heard of you. That's another radiodon that's quite important.
And that is my world famous herdia joke.
Yeah. Congratulations to that.
This podcast is going to get cancelled.
Oh no.
Right. Okay. So we've got all of this Cambrian life now. It's gorgeous. I encourage everyone to look into it. But once it's arrived, what happens to it? I mean, we've suddenly got all of these animals and organisms that appear. Is that it? Do we just have the diversity now for the rest of time and just things go extinct from there? Or were there further diversification events that followed?
Of course, it went on because it was actually sort of just starting. But if you look at the diversity curves we have today, so which are actually in some respects quite fancy with all sorts of calculation, like kind of trying to grasp the amount of things we don't know, filling the gaps and so on. If you take all that into account, we can at the moment say that except for, of course, the mass extinctions, we have kind of a steady increase in diversity from then until today. And so actually there's some colleagues of us who claim that actually the Cambrian explosion cannot be strictly separated from the diversification that happened in the Ordovician, which is called the Great Ordovician Biodiversification Event, or shortly GOBI. And actually, if you look into Ordovician sediments on the planet, sometimes it's also quite stunning what we have there. For example, what has become quite famous is the Fezouata Formation in Morocco, which is in a beautiful desert area, which is actually great for traveling because you have excellent food in a really Martian-like looking landscape. And very friendly people and so on. So that's a really amazing place to do fieldwork, and where in the past decades, stunning fossils have been found that are of a similar quality as those from the Burgess Shale or from Jingxiang in China.
So it just kept on going. So what would you call an explosion that doesn't stop exploding? A fire?
Yeah, something like that. A spreading fire, I would say. So life is continuing, is spreading, is diversifying since basically then. And of course, there were these big mass extinctions everybody probably heard about. But even these mass extinctions actually were some sort of engines of biodiversification and evolution, because usually what happened that after the big mass extinctions, the diversification actually intensified in many cases. So we have basically a ditch in the diversity and then another explosion, if you want. So life seems to be pretty resilient, and I hope it survives what we're doing to life at the moment. But back to the Ordovician, it's really stunning what we find in that time. We find again big anomalocarids, which reached several meters in length. And what I didn't mention before, even though they are my favorite group, the cephalopods, they originated in the late Cambrian, and they reached gigantic sizes in the Ordovician. I think, if I'm not mistaken, they were actually the largest animals of that time.
Right. So what are the cephalopods? Are we saying cephalopods or cephalopods?
That's a good question. And actually, I switch back and forth all the time. So I was told that it comes from the term cephalon, which is the Greek word for head. So that's why recently I decided to more often use cephalopods.
Right.
Even though it feels awkward to me, because before I always said cephalopods, and in German, cephalopoden. You have to ask linguists for the proper reply to that question. But in any case, they're a really cool group because they include the most intelligent animals today that do not have a spine, so invertebrates. And in the Paleozoic, so in the Ordovician, for example, there are some of the most awkward forms you can imagine. And, well, these large ones I was just mentioning, the endocerids, or also the giant genus Camarocerus, they maybe didn't look so special from the outside because they were basically gigantic ice cones, if you want, with tentacles dangling out of it. But they reached a size of 10 meters. And actually, if you look at the inside, they're quite interesting. But of course, unfortunately, we don't have the soft tissues preserved, so we can only make educated guesses about what their soft parts, like their tentacles, their eyes, their brain, their internal organs would have looked like.
Okay, so why have they got this big shell? Well, let's do a bit of anatomy of them. They've got this big shell. They've got the tentacles sticking out. What's going on inside of that shell?
Well, it's actually pretty simple. So what they have is usually they have a jaw, and this jaw looks a little bit like bird's beaks, and it's actually chitinous usually. But we don't have it from endocerids. The oldest jaw-like structure we have from an orthoceras, but also from the Ordovician. And then they also had a special kind of tongue, because this tongue carried small denticles. But this is also not known from endocerids, but it's known from orthocerids, another weird group that starts in the Ordovician. And this tongue you can also see in today's snails, and they actually use this so-called rasping tongue to grind down their food, to grind algae off surfaces, and so on. And in the case of the endocerids, orthocerids, camarocerids, and so on, it is likely that they caught prey with their arms somehow. Then they processed it on a coarse level into pieces, like we would do with our jaws and teeth, like make it into smaller pieces. But then they further pre-processed it before it went into the digestive tract. And then the digestive tract was sort of simple. There was an esophagus, there was some kind of stomach, there were digestive glands, and then it was excreted into something that is called the mantle cavity. And the mantle cavity is something which is basically, well, sort of a hollow space that was filled with mostly with seawater. And it was used for almost everything. So basically the shit went into it. There were the gills, so for breathing it was needed. Then all the sexual products like eggs and sperms were produced there. And they were used for swimming, because when the mantle cavity contracts, it expels water out of the funnel, and this is used for swimming movements. But in the case of the Ordovician forms, I assume they were probably not very rapid swimmers. Because if you imagine you have a 8 meter long cone-shaped conch, and you're basically dangling more or less obliquely or vertically in the water, then it's sort of difficult to turn yourself into the horizontal position and then swim with your basically well-streamlined conch, but it's somehow difficult. And also what one has to bear in mind, there were no big predators that would have been a danger for an endocerid. So they were pretty safe. They could take it easy and just fish out of the water whatever they wanted.
Wow. It's great that we have such a view of their anatomy and ecology in a lot of ways. And to my mind, this is the first documentary that shows these animals oriented vertically. So even in a lot of museums, if you go and have a look at a diorama of the Ordovician, you'll have these giant Camarocerus and the other endocerids, and they'll all be horizontal, just like hanging out in the reef, just a big long cone in the middle of it all. So what is the thinking behind having this vertical orientation?
So it's actually very complex, because the endocerids, they are named after the so-called endocones, which are cone-shaped deposits of basically limestone in the tip of their cone-shaped shell. And so it was always discussed, was this mass of limestone that was in the tip, was it enough to make the shell basically tilt into a horizontal position? So, and that is still not 100% clear. It's a matter of debate. But what is maybe more important, these animals were huge. We're talking something of a documented 6, 7, 8 meters to a report from the 19th century where, where it was claimed that there was a report from a quarry near New York, actually, where there was supposedly a specimen that measured 10 meters. But there's no photo, there's no remains in a collection or anything, so we cannot be certain about it. But I can well imagine that animals of that size existed as well. So if you look into large animals in the sea today, you run into animals like baleen whales, like the whale shark, and so on. And all these animals are filter feeders. So they were, instead of eating other big animals, they specialized on eating a lot of small animals by filtering. And so this is what has been proposed for Camarocerus and the other relatives that belong to the endocerids, that they were filter feeders and that they were maybe vertical migrants. This means they had a very thick siphuncle which connected their chambers, that their conch was chambered, and these chambers likely contained to some degree some gas and maybe also some water. And in total, it allowed them to float with neutral buoyancy in the water without big effort. And the siphuncle was so thick that maybe they were able of exchanging water and gas from this chambered part, and maybe they were able of moving up and down reasonably quickly. And while they were going up and down in the water column, they fished maybe planktonic organisms and maybe a lot of them, and thereby managed to grow to these large sizes.
Yeah, I'd like to think of the chambers inside the conch. I like to think of them as like the ballast tanks in a submarine. Is that accurate?
Well, in a way it is, because what they share is that the conch or shell is actually hard. It's rigid. So if you would take a hammer, it would fall into splinters. And also inside the chambers, there was actually probably a pressure, an air pressure that corresponds to the pressure of the air we are breathing. So that in turn is a difference to submarines. And because I think in many cases, the air in submarines is maybe pressured, but I'm not a submarine expert. So maybe some people who know more about submarines than I do would say, no, that's wrong. It's different. I don't know. But in any case, from modern cephalopods such as Nautilus, we know that the gas pressure within the chambers is actually close to surface pressure, so the pressure of the air we are breathing here at the surface. So that being said, there can be quite a contrast in pressure. So these shells were really quite sturdy, and they could withstand enormous pressures. We don't know how deep they went, but the fossils we find, they're usually from sediments that were laid down in moderate depths. So they didn't go down to the abyss of the deepest deep sea trenches to thousands of meters of depth, but they would probably stayed really in the top 100 or 200 or maybe 300 meters of water depth, because otherwise probably their conchs would have imploded.
Wow. Yeah. Here is a question, though. And if they are going to be filter feeding, mustn't have plankton evolved before them? Do we see the evolution of plankton?
We do indeed. Because actually, before the Cambrian, there was a long evolution of single cellular organisms, of course, algae and bacteria, but also zooplankton. And even the Cambrian, we find actually quite a lot of these small remains of zooplankton. And we know it was around, like, for example, larvae of all sorts of arthropods and so on. So there was floating life for sure. And I can imagine that was really enough for filter feeders, especially if they're moving at, let's say, a very chill speed, because it could be that these movements were actually quite slow. But for them, there was no need to hurry, because, as I said, there were no bigger predators. So there was no one who would be chasing them. There were no sharks. There were no orcas or so. There were no big swimming vertebrates. All the vertebrates, all the fish that existed back then, they were really quite small and probably quite close to the seafloor. And most importantly, they lacked, the most of them at least, lacked jaws. So they wouldn't have been able to do any harm to an endocerid or to Camarosaurus, to be more specific.
Yeah, they might have slurped some algae off of it.
Yeah, or maybe something. Small trilobites, or I don't know what, something.
Yeah. So we do see Arundaspis in the episode, just swimming about, and it's great to see those as well. So we've got all of these different animals. We've got trilobites, we've got the cephalopods, vertebrates, we've got the anomalocaridids that we see as well. What happened to them all?
So some survived in a way, or at least gave rise to other groups, and some became extinct. I mentioned mass extinctions before, and extinctions are actually quite a normal thing. Although, of course, I think every human being thinks it's sad when, for example, the rhinoceros species become extinct or so. And that's always something we miss because we know it afterwards. But mass extinctions are a normal process, and it always happened. And of course, there were also bigger phases of more intense extinctions where many groups vanished. And one of these phases of mass extinctions happened actually at the end of the Ordovician. And in this case, it wasn't maybe too dramatic, because what happened is that there was a big glaciation that happened actually in the former South Pole, which was actually on Gondwana. And what happened there was that a lot of ice formed actually inland in the former Gondwana, and it bound a lot of water on land, which caused sea levels to fall. And this and the consequences caused some animal groups like, for the anomalocaridids, it's actually not 100% certain, because there's a questionable fossil from the Devonian, which might be the last survivor, so to say, of the group. But most of them at least became extinct.
Yeah. One of the things I find interesting is that there's not really the loss of whole groups as there are in a lot of other mass extinctions. It's more like a big percentage of every group went extinct, rather than a 100% of a specific group. So it wasn't very super selective in that way. But still, yeah, it was a big one. It was the second biggest, I think.
Well, that always depends on how you count, you know, like, yeah. If you just take taxon counts, if you take there's different measures how to judge the severity of a mass extinction. So the ranking depend on the measures you use. So that's, but I can imagine that in according to some measures, it might actually be ranked quite near the top. So the most important one is still the one at the end of the Paleozoic. At the end of the Permian, this is still the most severe one, but the Ordovician is among the top five for sure.
But the important thing is that the cephalopods got through it, and I don't think we see them. We do see some again later on. I think we've got some cuttlefish.
That's nice. Yeah. That is such an awesome group, and. Of course, it makes you wonder what elements of, let's say, behavior and anatomy did these early forms share with our modern cuttlefish and octopuses. And I'm sure there are some things. I'm sure they had eyes. I could even imagine that they had lens eyes, like modern cuttlefish do. They probably also had a reasonably developed brain. And yeah, so yeah, this is also maybe interesting because as soon as these mollusks took off from the seafloor, they had to develop sensory systems and, of course, the according computing system, namely the brain, to handle all the data they needed to understand where they actually were. Because in contrast to a snail, which is crawling along the seafloor, if you're in murky water, you have to know what's up and down, what's left and right, and so on. So they needed to further develop and refine the sensory systems. And of course, the data that were produced by these sensors, they needed to be computed. And hence, they needed more fancy brains and nervous systems in general.
Okay. And so to end on, we've got our cephalods through the Endor division. So now, could you fill us in on 500 million years, half a billion years of cephalopod evolution? What are some of the most amazing fossil ones that we see? What are some of the most amazing things that cephalopods do in general?
So what I love about cephalopods is there's a bunch of really crazy things. For example, you remember the endocerids, they had this cone-shaped shell. And in the Carboniferous, actually, there was another time of glaciation, by the way. Suddenly, for some reason, they decided to put the conch inside the soft part. And this was basically the origin of the coleoids, which comprise all octopuses and squids and sepias, the cuttlefishes today. So that's quite interesting thing. And what I find quite amazing is that from the fossil evidence we have, it seems like at first they didn't have an ink sac like today's cuttlefishes and octopuses and so on, but this really evolved shortly thereafter. So this is one quite amazing event, I find. Then, of course, the origin of ammonoids. That's one of my favorite groups. And they're quite important in the later part of the Paleozoic and the Mesozoic. And many of those people listening here probably know what they are or have seen or even found them at one point. I think they're quite amazing. And they grew really strange forms in the Cretaceous. And there were giant animals that reached over 2 meters in size. And we once made, together with Kenneth, a colleague of mine who now works in Warsaw, we made estimates for the number of offspring they produce because we actually know what the hatchlings looked like. And we found that probably such a big ammonite mama produced between 10 and 100 million eggs. And that's quite a lot.
Sorry, did you say 10 and 100 million?
Yes. So there must have been clouds of small ammonite babies swimming around the seas in the Cretaceous and maybe earlier on as well. And then, of course, what I already mentioned is the brains. If you look at modern octopuses, they are really, really cool because, I mean, they have three hearts. They have some sort of arm brains. So their arms, they are capable of, well, semi-independent movements. And they do really, really cool. For example, they can open jars with screwed lids. If they want to fetch something from the inside, they understand how to open them. They can recognize individual human beings in aquariums, like the giant Pacific octopus is known that it can identify individual humans visually and also maybe by taste. Then, of course, they can taste with their suckers. They can taste us. They can identify us using their suckers and so on. So I think there's many, many, many exciting aspects about cephalopods.
Clouds of little ammonoid babies. I don't know if it's too late to change the documentary now, but I really want to ring up Netflix and make this happen. Ah, could you imagine seeing that in CGI? Just all of these millions of baby ammonoids just floating around.
Yeah. And I think they were probably important food for many filter feeders, as Camarosaurus was in the Ordovician. There were, of course, filter feeders in the Cretaceous. And I think they were probably also important food for them.
Yeah, brilliant. Well, Yeah, as I said, with the Cambrian, with the Paleozoic, I feel like we could just talk forever and ever. But we've got the rest of the history of life on our planet to get through. So thanks so much for talking us through this, Christian.
You're very welcome. It was a pleasure.